Having chosen one of the household attendants, Sanekata brought him to Yoshichika, who gave his instructions. People standing nearby were speculating about the contents of this message, but I was too far away to hear. Presently, the messenger, looking so self-important that people could not help laughing, swaggered over to the carriage that Yoshichika had indicated and spoke to the lady inside. "No doubt she's busy with a poem," someone joked as the messenger stood there waiting. "Come, Captain Sanekata, why don't you frame a reply?" It was amusing to see how everyone, from the most dignified high court noble down to the ordinary people standing out in the open, was watching the carriage with mounting impatience. At last, the man began walking off. Had she finally given him a message? Only to be summoned back with a wave of the lady's fan. It occurred to me that she may have made a mistake in the wording of her poem. But after taking such a long time, this was certainly not the proper way to do things. Well, well, what was her answer? What did she say? People asked when the messenger finally returned, but he would divulge nothing. On being summoned by Yoshichika, the messenger started to report in a pompous, measured style. "Be quick about it," Michitaka interposed. "Say what you have to say without straining for effect. And mind, you don't make any mistakes." "Well, sir," I heard the messenger say, "it really does not matter how I report such a reply. The major counselor, Fujiwara no Tamemitsu, craned his neck forward. He seemed the most curious of all. After the messenger had reported, Michitaka remarked, "It seems to be the case of bending a very straight tree and breaking it in the process." Tamemitsu burst out laughing, and everyone joined in without quite knowing why. I wondered whether the lady could hear them. "But look here," said Yoshichika to the messenger. "What did she say before she called you back? Tell us her exact words without trying to improve on them." "Well, sir," said the messenger, "she was a long time without replying at all. When I said that I had better be going, she called me back." "And whose carriage is it? Who is she?" Yoshichika asked. Just as the priest mounted the dais and everyone fell silent. While the entire congregation was attending to the service, the lady's carriage disappeared as if it had vanished from the face of the earth. I remember that its inner blinds and other fittings looked brand new. The lady had worn a set of dark purple robes over a violet garb of figured material. Above it all was a thin cloak of dark red. Her formal skirt with its printed pattern had been allowed to spread so that the train hung over the back of the carriage. Who could she be, I wondered, and was her reaction to Yoshichika's message as improper as it seemed? I have heard people suggest that no reply at all is better than a bad one, with which I quite agree. Seihan, the priest who officiated at the morning service, looked resplendent on his dais. Nothing could have been more impressive. But we did not want to stay. For one thing, the heat was overpowering. Besides, we had set out in the morning with the intention of hearing only part of the service and had various things to finish at home that could not be put off. However, since our carriage was in the forefront, with row after row of other carriages piled up behind us like waves, it was impossible to retreat. We sent messages to the occupants of the other carriages saying that we should like to leave as soon as the morning service was over. No doubt delighted at the possibility of coming a little closer to the dais, they immediately began to make an opening for us. Seeing us leave so early, many of the onlookers, including some elderly high court nobles, made quite audible jokes at our expense. But we paid no attention and refused to reply. As we were squeezing our way out, Yoshichika laughingly called to me, "Ah, you do well to depart." Overcome by the heat, I paid no attention to this quip. But later, I sent a man with a message. "Your Excellency, too, will surely be among the 5,000. And so we left the crowd and returned home. I remember a certain carriage that remained outside smaller Shirakawa from the very beginning of the services until the last day. Not once did anyone go up to speak to the person who occupied it. I was much impressed by this mysterious vehicle that stood there as immobile as a carriage in a picture. "Who can it be in that splendid carriage?" I said. "How can one find out?" Overhearing me, Tamemitsu remarked, "It does not look very splendid to me. Quite the contrary. I am sure the occupant is an odious creature." I was amused by the comment. After the 20th of the month, the middle counselor became a priest, which caused me much regret. That the cherry blossoms should scatter in the wind is the way of the world. But the counselor had certainly not reached the age of waiting for the dew to fall. 24. It is so stiflingly hot in the 7th month that even at night one keeps all the doors and lattices open. At such times, it is delightful to wake up when the moon is shining and to look outside. I enjoy it even when there is no moon. But to wake up at dawn and see a pale sliver of the moon in the sky, well, I need hardly say how perfect that is. I like to see a bright new straw mat that has just been spread out on a well-polished floor. The best place for one's 3-foot curtain of state is in the front of the room near the veranda. It is pointless to put it in the rear of the room, as it is most unlikely that anyone will peer in from that direction. It is dawn, and a woman is lying in bed after her lover has taken leave. She is covered up to her head with a light mauve robe that has a lining of dark violet. The color of both the outside and the lining is fresh and glossy. The woman who appears to be asleep wears an unlined orange robe and a dark crimson skirt of stiff silk whose cords hang loosely by her side, as if they have been left untied. Her thick tresses tumble over each other in cascades, and one can imagine how long her hair must be when it falls freely down her back. Nearby, another woman's lover is making his way home in the misty dawn. He is wearing loose violet trousers, an orange hunting costume, so lightly colored that one can hardly tell whether it has been dyed or not. A white robe of stiff silk and a scarlet robe of glossy beaten silk. His clothes, which are damp from the mist, hang loosely about him. From the dishevelment of his sidelocks, one can tell how negligently he must have tucked his hair into his black lacquered headdress when he got up. He wants to return and write his next morning letter before the dew on the morning glories has had time to vanish. But the path seems endless, and to divert himself, he hums "The Sprouts in the Flax Fields." As he walks along, he passes a house with an open lattice. He is on his way to report for official duty, but cannot help stopping to lift up the blind and peep into the room. It amuses him to think that a man has probably been spending the night here and has only recently got up to leave, just as happened to himself. Perhaps that man, too, had felt the charm of the dew. Looking around the room, he notices near the woman's pillow an open fan with a magnolia frame and purple paper. And at the foot of her curtain of state, he sees some narrow strips of Michinoku paper and also some other paper of faded color, either orange, red, or maple. The woman senses that someone is watching her and, looking up from under her bedclothes, sees the gentleman leaning against the wall by the threshold, a smile on his face. She can tell at once that he is the sort of man with whom she need feel no reserve. All the same, she does not want to enter into any familiar relations with him, and she is annoyed that he should have seen her asleep. "Well, well, madame," says the man, leaning forward so the upper part of his body comes behind her curtains. "What a long nap you are having this morning. You really are a lie-abed." "You call me that, sir," she replied, "only because you're annoyed at having to get up before the dew has had time to settle." Their conversation may be commonplace, yet I find there is something delightful about the scene. Now the gentleman leans further forward and, using his own fan, tries to get a hold of the fan by the woman's pillow. Fearing his closeness, she moves further back into the curtain enclosure, her heart pounding. The gentleman picks up the magnolia fan and, while examining it, says in a slightly bitter tone, "How standoffish you are." But now it is growing light. There is a sound of people's voices, and it looks as if the sun will soon be up. Only a short while ago, this same man was hurrying home to write his next morning letter before the mists had time to clear. Alas, how easily his intentions have been forgotten. While all this is afoot, the woman's original lover has been busy with his own next morning letter, and now, quite unexpectedly, the messenger arrives at her house. The letter is attached to a spray of bush clover, still damp with dew, and the paper gives off a delicious aroma of incense. Because of the new visitor, however, the woman's servants cannot deliver it to her. Finally, it becomes unseemly for the gentleman to stay any longer. As he goes, he is amused to think that a similar scene may be taking place in the house he left earlier that morning. The end. Various footnotes. When Michitaka says, "It seems to be the case of bending a very straight tree and breaking it in the process," he is referring to a poem about a man who was always looking for qualities and charms where they could not reasonably be expected. "The straightest tree grows, many a crooked branch." Foolish it is to blow the hair and so uncover faults. That is to say, since even the best objects and people in this world have imperfections, there is no point in expecting normal things or people to be ideal. Rather, we should leave well enough alone. In this particular case, Yoshichika has expected too much from the unknown woman in the carriage. By demanding a good poem, straightening the branches, he has spoiled everything, broken the tree. The way in which Michitaka changes the reference to the tree imagery while retaining the central point of the original verse is typical of the technique of poetic quotation of Shonagon's time. Another footnote. When she talks about the set of robes, she is referring to a set of unlined silk robes worn by women and usually matched to produce a subtle blending of colors. The sleeves of each dress were normally longer than the ones over it. When traveling in carriages, women often let the sleeves of their various robes hang outside the blinds. This allowed Shonagon to see exactly what the unknown lady wore. Another footnote. When she says, "As we were squeezing our way out," Yoshichika laughingly called to me, "Ah, you do well to depart." Yoshichika is referring to a passage in the Lotus Sutra, the main text of that morning's service, in which the Buddha comments to his disciple, Sariputra, on the fact that 5,000 people in the congregation have left while he was in the middle of preaching. People of such pride do well to depart. Shonagon picks up the reference with her usual acumen and implies that Yoshichika, by using the Buddha's own words, is no less guilty of pride than the people who left. When Shonagon talks about the late night tryst, it was an essential part of Heian etiquette for the man to write a love letter to the lady with whom he had spent the night. It usually included a poem and was attached to a spray of some appropriate flower. The letter had to be sent as soon as the man returned home, or, if he was on duty, as soon as he reached his office. The lady was, of course, expected to send a prompt reply. If the man failed to send a letter, it normally meant he had no desire to continue the liaison. Humming the Sprouts of Flax Seeds is from the poem, The Sprouts of the Cherry Flax. In the flax fields are heavy now with dew. I shall stay with you till dawn, though your parents be aware. The expression cherry flax is found in a similar poem in the Manyo Shu and refers, one, to the fact that flax was sown at the same time that the cherries blossomed, and two, to the similarity in appearance between cherry blossoms and the leaves of flax. His ostensible reason is that it is hard to make his way through the heavy morning dew, a standard euphemism. The real motive, of course, is his reluctance to leave the partner of his night's pleasures. Okay, really the end this time. おやすみなさい。